Speaking of anthropology, my name is Dylan.
And my name is Kevin.
And we are back for another episode, another interview, return to form here on the 19th of November, 2021 on KCUA 91.5 FM Fairbanks. And joining us today is a new guest, someone we haven't spoken to before on the show. Georgie Reynolds. So welcome to the show, and thank you for coming on today.
My pleasure.
To start out with, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself briefly, who you are, just a little bit about maybe your background in Alaska and you and those sorts of just connections for folks who might not be familiar with you and your work.
I first came to Alaska in 1977 to work on the PET4 or NPRA project and was captivated immediately. I had already gotten the bug, however, a few years earlier when I took a circumpolar course with Bob Humphrey, who wrote his dissertation on the Uticock River. So I was just astounded and amazed to be up there. I met a few people. I met most of the Alaska archaeology crowd and determined I was going to get a PhD. So I enrolled at UConn and studied, that's University of Connecticut. A lot of people thought it was the UConn, but it was University of Connecticut under Bill Laughlin, who was a great Aleutian specialist, but kind of nutso. So I left that program and went to SUNY Binghamton, State University of New York at Binghamton, which has produced some wonderful Arctic archaeologists, because our mentor, Al Deakin, the late great Al Deakin, I think he did his field work in Canada and then migrated up during the pipeline. But anyway, he knew all the people I knew and more, and encouraged me. And I finished my dissertation in 1994 while I was in Anchorage. And I have, I moved back east to be near family, in 1998, but never lost touch with Alaska. I go back, at least once a year. I was in Fairbanks in September. I was amazed when I walked in Fred Meyer and no one had a mask on. It's like a different world. But yeah, I do get up to Fairbanks and I have friends in Anchorage. What else would you like to know?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm curious if you wouldn't mind to go back a little bit to the beginning of your story of what got you interested in anthropology in the first place, and then how that became archaeology specifically for you, right? Especially as some of the folks who listen to the show and stuff, Kevin and I in the past have, kind of struggled with, even if we know anthropology for sure, how do we then pick a subfield of anthropology, right, and go either archaeology or something. So if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about your personal experiences with getting into anthropology and then archaeology later on, or picking archaeology specifically.
Well, it was always archaeology. My mom got me a book, the big golden book of archaeology when I was about eight. I was fascinated, especially by Mesoamerica and the steles and the pyramids and all this kind of stuff. I was entranced, and there was Machu Picchu and there was Cahokia and blah, 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 blah. And I never lost that interest. When I went to college, my folks tried to make me forget all about that, though. They said, if you go into anthropology, you're not going to get a job, which I realized was a substantial possibility. And when I was looking over my roommate's shoulders at their intro, I think, to physical anthropology book, I thought, wow, that is so neat. And I had an interview with the chairman of the department, Bob Humphrey, and learned that I had to get my degrees in anthropology, not archaeology. In Britain, it's different, and perhaps all of Europe. You know, you get your degree in archaeology or social anthropology. But no, I had to learn the gamut. So I studied linguistics, physical anthropology, which I loved, social anthropology, you know, and ethnography and all this other stuff. But I was still really into archaeology. So I finished my BA and MA under Bob Humphrey. Master's degree in 1973. And soon after that, I saw an ad for work in Alaska. And I wasn't quite brave enough that year, but I went the following year and I met all these archaeologists. And I decided to leave Bill Laughlin, which is a good thing. I was his most recent refugee at that point, and poor soul is dead now. He wasn't a great archaeologist, but a great physical anthropologist. I learned about bones from him and transferred to SUNY Binghamton with Al Deakin. And I haven't looked back. He brought me to Alaska in the 80s to work on Utqiagvik and supervised my dissertation.
Yeah, there's, Georgie, there's something about anthropology, I think. So both, maybe a little background, Dylan, both of us completed our social anthropology degrees here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And so our bias is towards social anthropology, but like you, Georgia, we also took, you know, archaeology, physical anthropology, linguistics, you know, this new fifth field, applied anthropology, and then, you know, all the subfields of within anthropology that are so interdisciplinary, right? And all that. And yeah, you know, that's something that I think we strive to on this show to try to delineate and differentiate, but also correlate, because there's so many similarities that come out of a research project as such. But yeah, I don't unless Dylan has any follow up questions, I really wanted maybe ask you. So you just mentioned you did some work in Utqiagvik and other places here in Alaska, and then, you know, I like that Yukon, you know, a suggestion, but maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the research you've done here in Alaska. And maybe if you want to give a shout out, because since this is Fairbanks, if you know anybody here, that'd be good too.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, I'm still in touch with Mr. Mike Kunz, who is one of my idols. He certainly, if there is one person, well, there's two, Mike and Dale Slaughter, who lives in Anchorage, who I would trust my life to, in the tundra or any other wild place, it's the two of them. I worked on the Mesa site with Mike for, I think it was two seasons. We were out of the Lisburn site, which is just to the north. Mike worked for BLM then, and I accompanied him on some of his research proposals or research. Who else do I know up there? Do you know Dave Libby, ethnographer? Well, he's in, I forget the name of it, but he's in a retirement home right now and has been refusing to participate in little AAA meetings. But he's one of the most wily people I've ever known. Been up here for, well, decades. You know, I ran into him once in Point Hope. You know, I had no idea he was going to be there. And we went walking around the old sites and he was interviewing people. He had a way with people that the people would let him interview them and they were totally at ease with him. There are so many people I know up there. It's hard to single out some. Pete Bowers, if you know Pete Bowers. I don't really know the social anthropology crowd, and my knowledge of Fairbanks and the profs, et cetera, is pretty old by now. Like when I got up to Fairbanks, John Cook had just left to go to BLM. Gene Eigner was there about to be drummed out. Roger Powers was there. He was very interesting to talk to. And I guess the social anthropologists were in the field at that time. because I really didn't run into them. We were always running, you know, trying to get our packs ready and duffels and stuff and fly up to the slope.
Yeah, I will say, just with, you know, despite having focused mostly on cultural anthropology in my undergraduate, like working for the UA Museum of the North and stuff, right, mm-hmm. having seen, you know, sometimes besides like the little AAAs, the Alaska Anthropological Association meetings and stuff, it can be a little difficult at times maybe to get the sociocultural folks and the archaeologists in the same room, because everyone just has, you know, is often disparate projects, is out in the field, you know, and especially in summertime, right? Everyone's just trying to get all their work, and especially the archaeological folks, you know, but still, like, it can be very, very busy and active times for research that make it hard to get everybody together, which is, I guess, why we do have, you know, our own conference, right, for that sort of thing in February, right? So
we used to think, the archaeologists, me included, used to think that historians and social anthropologists didn't want to get their hands dirty. You know, I've revised my opinion, though.
That's something that I think a lot of prospective anthropologists coming into the field saying, hey, you know, you have two options. One's out in the field or one's in the lab. And that just somewhat differentiates and determines what your, you know, field you might go into at times, I think, you know, or whether or not you don't want to do anthropology and you want to do biology or be a wildlife biologist, right? It goes on and on.
Here's the thing. Most archaeologists I know start out being extremely introverted. I sure didn't want to talk to natives back in the 70s. They scared me. You know, they were different and they talked back. I mean, the people, you know, we dug up the artifacts from people who had lived thousands of years ago. They didn't talk back. And, you know, a lot of archaeologists like to just zone out in their square and trowel away and wait for the big artifact to appear. But since I had the tribal desk at headquarters, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, I've had to revise my worldview, and it's been a very positive change. I love talking to people now.
There definitely is a certain set of stereotypes, right, about like the, even the folks attracted to sociocultural anthropology is like, they're, you know, maybe the people who also struggle to talk to people, and that's why they've become so interested, right, in studying people. So the people who felt like they never, you know, fit in or something, right? And so it's definitely interesting how both in archaeologists and in you know, sociocultural anthropology, you can see these sorts of maybe similar stereotypes, and it just results in maybe two different ways of responding to it when that is actually the case for the, you know, for people. It's not, obviously, not every archaeologist, although a lot that I've met as well are introverted, but not all of them are. And not every sociocultural anthropologist has always felt like an outsider, but there, you know, there definitely are these sorts of perceptions of the people who are attracted to both fields for sure. And it is kind of interesting, right, in terms of, you know, turning inward and looking at our own field for a second and the people who wind up, you know, in anthropology, to see what attracts people to the field. So I always enjoy hearing those kinds of things and talking about that with folks for sure.
Do you want me to fill in there? I will say that since I had the tribal job back east and I flew all around the country, including Hawaii and Alaska, that I have made friends. I have made connections, deep connections with indigenous people, and I treasure those. And a lot of them were friends on Facebook, you know. And I volunteer for the Society of American Indian Government Employees. And I've been a member for years, even though, as far as I know, I don't have a drop of Native blood in me. But there's a sense of camaraderie there when we put on our yearly conference, which is in, I think this year it's in September in Tulsa. And we hope to have an in-person conference this year. But I have bonded with the other board members and some of the members. It's been truly enriching. And some of my best friends come from my time on the Indian desk, as it was called. It changed me, is what I'm trying to say.
Definitely. Georgie, if you don't mind maybe explaining your role currently with, I think you said that in the Indian Affairs, if you could just talk a little bit about that and maybe what that role is. And you mentioned a conference as well, which is really interesting. Is there like a theme around that?
We're trying to decide the theme right now because we've got, 8 months or something like that until the next conference. I'm retired, but I'm a consultant also. I got the tribal job in 2003 and was scared out of my wits, absolutely scared, because I'm used to looking in a pit, you know. But the tribal people trusted me. They could tell I was totally naive. And they taught me a whole lot of things. I remember the first time I was considered an elder, which was someplace in Michigan at a casino that a tribe owned. And they had moose and they had venison and they had this, that, and the other thing. And I was invited to go up first because I'm old. And that was a long time ago. What I did was I basically went around the country when other local offices had issues. That's how it started, and would meet with the tribes. The first meeting I went to was in Rapid City, South Dakota, I believe. I got to know South Dakota really well. And there were tribal leaders there, and they were, as they call it, testifying about their tribe, the history of their tribe, and how the Corps had done them wrong. And I got off on the right foot, fortunately, by simply not answering. I just listened. And there's a tape of me, and I forget which district has it, which Corps district, but I'm looking up at a very tall Native American guy named Tex Hall, who was he was head of the National Congress of American Indians, and he's from Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara, that reservation. And he goes, "Well, I suppose we'll try you." And I thought, oh my God, I had better produce. I had better do good. And I realized how important it was and how a lot of Indigenous people don't have a voice. And they still don't, but they're growing. Their voice is growing. Not that many people graduate from high school or college, but the ones that I know of that do, that excel, become lawyers. And they know your rules and regs better than you do. So I tend to just listen. And that's done me well.
Yeah. Just being able to sit and be open to things, right? And to listen to what the people themselves actually have to say, you know, and what the concerns are and the experiences that they're running into, right? And clearly that's an invaluable skill for anybody in both the world in general and, you know, across anthropology, I think, as a field as well. But I'm kind of curious then to touch on that a little bit of, you know, since you have had experience with this for, you know, a bit now, what sort of shifts you've seen, right? Because I know in a lot of anthropology and the social sciences, it's kind of considered now that we have definitely been moving in, you know, especially over maybe like the past 20 years into concerns about issues of post-colonialism and stuff and moving away from the sort of Western settler colonialist created framework that, you know, has governed a lot of both obviously the United States and societies in North America, as well as the academy and stuff, right, and scientific research. And so that is, you know, something of an interest that has been burgeoning for a bit now, right? So I'm curious what sort of maybe shifts in the landscape of these sorts of issues that you have seen and that you have dealt with over time, or maybe growing awareness of various peoples outside of tribal communities and stuff about these issues, or anything, you know, that has just kind of moved over time on these sorts of topics in your experience?
Well, the most pressing issue has been for quite a while sovereignty. And when it was first mentioned to me, I must say I did not know what that is. I had never heard of it. Consultation, government to government consultation. I think when I first came on board in 2003, the tribes were a little bit hesitant to press the issues. And I'm sure there are far more reticent in times before that. But now you had best consult with a tribe or you will be in trouble, because they know those regs, they know the laws, they know ARPA, they know NAGPRA and the National Historic Preservation Act. So I think they're stepping up to the plate. And if they don't have the expertise, they hire someone does, because a lot of tribes have money now. A lot of them are impoverished, but, you know, several have money and sometimes they'll band together. You know, I once talked, this is years ago, to the head of the Alaska Native Association. You'll have to correct me if I'm wrong with that title, but, you know, the big Native organization in Alaska, because I was pegged as the staff archaeologist in Alaska to deal with the natives. Anyway, so I was talking with the head of it, Nelson, and I don't remember Nelson's last name. And he said, do you think we all get along, the tribes, the various villages? And I said, well, I don't know. And he goes, no, we don't. But we band together to fight you. And he pointed to me. And that has stuck in my mind since the 90s, I guess. And I've met some, you know, wonderful Native leaders up north, but mostly in the lower 48, because that's where I did most of my work. So sovereignty is a pressing issue. What I have found is that we started a class education in the Corps of Engineers. First, it was just for the Corps, and then everybody else started glomming onto it because it's free. I mean, it didn't cost us much to put on. We'd always have tribal members participate no matter where we were. The local district would take care of which tribal members from which area would participate. And most of the attendees had never met a Native American before. And, you know, their eyes were wide with surprise because this was maybe not what they were expecting. One of the revelations I had in one of our courses, I think it was Tulsa, a Mr. Gover, G-O-V-E-R, he's related to the past president of NMAI, Kevin, no, that was the NMAI, I just don't remember his uncle's name. He stood up in the middle of one of our classes, interrupted the whoever was speaking, and he held up his ID card with his tribal affiliation. And he said, we're the only group of people that have to prove who we are. And that has stayed with me forever. So in the last course that we gave, which is right before I retired, December 2013, I said, please come back. And he did, and he stood up again, because most of the people were new. It's a constant re-education of people or agencies. You know, I worked at the federal level. People don't intrinsically know about sovereignty or the trust responsibility. You know, like, uh-huh. And you can't blame them because it's not taught in schools. So we would do our best to reverse that, and we would get a double dose of it from our tribal members. We also would put on formal presentations about consultation tips. That's the one I did. And I had a dear friend, I have a dear friend, who's a Potawatomi, and she would do relocated tribes. So it wasn't just the Trail of Tears, which was horrible enough, but it was like all over the Midwest and the East. And that was an eye-opener to a lot of people. You know, and how much they hate Jackson and all this kind of stuff, and the link between Jackson and Marshall. I forget the Marshall trilogy, their laws that, you know, Oh, this is digging back into my memory cells. I don't have my slide presentation in front of me, but all this came as news to people. And we would periodically go back to the same place, like Albuquerque, we would go to once every 5 years. And it was like, you're teaching the whole thing again, because that crop of people doesn't know. One of the saddest things a Native American said to me, she's from MHA, Mandan, Hadatsa, and Arikara again. She said, I am so tired of fighting. I just want to give up. You people don't learn, yada, yada, yada. And I said, please don't. We need you, because we're going to forget. And there's going to be new people, and they won't understand. And they'll just want to run roughshod over your land. Wonderful, wonderful job, and wonderful people.
I suppose that gets exactly at that, the crux of the systematic nature, right? Is you're dealing with these people who, like, who it's not just that they have, you know, maybe deliberately chosen to ignore these issues, but it's just that there's not any, as you said, there's little education about a lot of it, right? And there's just so many people where this is just not even something that they know to be concerned about, right? And so you're fighting against this whole structure of you know, the way that settler colonialism and the way that the U.S. has exercised its power over indigenous people. And part of that is by obfuscating the ways that it does that to other people, right? And to, you know, trying to just depict things in certain ways, right? And especially like with ideas about, you know, the sheer amount of people, for example, as you said, who have been displaced, right? And like, we associate that with the Trail of Tears, but obviously, like, there were many, many, many indigenous groups who relocated, whether that was, you know, for what we'd consider shorter distances, but still outside of their homeland, right? From Northern California into reservations in Oregon, for example, or, you know, these longer dislocations. But all this, right, is these very severe, you know, sorts of situations these people had to endure that were inflicted upon them, and that then kind of just people aren't taught about, right? And so these constant, you know, the constant struggle of education, yeah, that's got to be a really challenging, but as you said, like a really important topic to take on. Absolutely. And I will say too, just something that I've noticed real quick and where I'm at on the East Coast now is that there's not a lot of land acknowledgments, at least not here in New York. Most people don't seem to, you know, whereas in like Alaska and to an extent on the West Coast, there seems, you know, this conscious effort to say, well, this is, you know, Fairbanks, right? We know that's Trothieta, right? This is Athapascan land that wasn't, you know, ceded and that UAF now sits on, right? But I find that very interesting and very unfortunate that just doesn't seem to be as much of a thing in the widespread nature of it here that I've run into here in New York City. So yeah, just these sorts of differences that I've encountered recently. So
I had the extra added burden of working for the Army Corps, and the Army was the outfit that, you know, the cavalry rode in and massacred them. One of my friends, or still friends, she is a Lakota Sioux from Cheyenne River. She said, what you guys call battles, we call massacres. That has stuck in my brain for years.
Yeah. There's something I think maybe I can add to this conversation that's interesting speaking to you today, Georgie, a little bit about, you know, at least here in Alaska, we spend so much time thinking about, in terms of, you know, we talk here on campus and in academia, like traditional ecological knowledge, right? How do we, consultation is really like a big part of the work that you've done and how, but now I think a lot of the people in the anthropology field and social sciences are thinking, and in science as well, and across the spectrum of how do we connect indigenous people, you know, we scientists, them in the field, in their own communities to work with scientists here in urban cities, urban environments, at academic settings, right? So there's like this constant shifting, but it's interesting to hear, I think, you know, and then how do we kind of piece together, you know, a fruitful, respectful conversation amidst all the things that, you know, society has done to Native Americans through time, right? This is definitely a very, very difficult topic, I think. But it's I do want to just pull it back real quick, Georgie, and say it's really interesting that you come from an archaeology, like physical anthropology background. And now you're working essentially like a social anthropologist. And, you know, you're very much, you know, connecting, talking to people, you know, working with them on political issues, right, on sovereignty, you know, and these are things that I think, you know, as an anthropologist, you were already trained for. So maybe, yeah. You know, that's something that I think is really, really incredible. And I admire that of you and the adaptability of your career and ability, I'm sure, to see, you know, going from being the archaeologist, seeing that, you know, the drive of archaeologists, ambition to just dig and find something big. You know, of course, you know, the scene has changed where people used to just dig and, you know, without respect for indigenous people, but now it's changed, right? And we need to work with them and so on and so forth. So that's my brief monologue, Georgie and Dylan, on some of the thoughts we've talked about, but please, Georgie, yeah.
I might add that towards the end of my tenure at the Corps, I got smart, finally, and I would carry around a copy of the Constitution with me. And they would say, why do we have to yada, yada, yada? I'd say, it's in the Constitution, Article 1, Article 6. They are not just a bystander. They have special status. And also around the same time, I use that to get money. I'd say, we have to do this, and it's in the Constitution, so therefore fund my program. And the difference was you're saying about how to talk with indigenous people, get them into academia and stuff. What I have found is you have to go to them. The academics have to come into the field, and they do it together on the Indians' turf, which of course all land used to be theirs. But if you're going to work with the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, you got to go there. You got to talk about prairies and the Missouri River. You just don't sit in your office.
Yeah. And it's even more interesting, I think, these days because of COVID and Zoom, like we are here today, how do we adapt to that, right? It's essentially impossible sometimes to connect with people over a Zoom call, because, you know, you're not meeting them face to face. You're not having, you know, that conversation, that emotional, you know, attachment there, which is really interesting. I think a lot of young prospective anthropologists, maybe this is a question for you, Georgie, about, like, you know, how can we as anthropologists now adapt or continue to work on this consultation work with different peoples around the world, actually? Yeah, that's a big one. That's a big question.
That's a tough one.
Yeah. I'm Dylan and I have this show for this one reason, of trying to figure what this is all about too. So, we're working on it.
Well, you know, if people start getting vaccinated and wearing masks, at least in Fred Meyer's and Fairbanks, things will be better. And we can, talk to our counterparts, in villages. I don't really have a good handle on how bad the villages are right now. The tribal people I know are all for vaccination, but I don't know a large percentage of people, but I, you know, safety comes first. And it's tough because in my experience, people want to meet you, look you in the eye, ask you a few questions, and kind of put you on the spot, which they really can't do on a Zoom call. And some of them don't have Zoom. So I don't know. It's going to be a big thaw when this all goes away.
Yeah. I love the way you said it, the big thaw. we usually give a weather update, actually, Georgie. So why don't we do that real quick? I forgot. We were in a rush to just start and excited. Yeah. beautiful Fairbanks, negative 20 degrees outside today. It's Friday, November 19th.
I looked 19th. At your weather. Yeah, I have the weather on my iPhone. I look at it chilly. Every day.
Yeah. You're listening to Speaking of Anthropology here on KSUA 91.5 FM Fairbanks. Today we have Georgie Reynolds joining us, anthropologist, talking about what anthropology is, her work, her research, maybe her memoir, which I believe we will touch on a little bit too as well. Dylan, how's the weather in New York today? And then we'll ask Georgie as well after.
Yeah. So the weather here, yeah, I know we normally do it at the beginning of the show, not 40 minutes in, but that's okay. It's about 45 here right now, I think. It was raining last night, so I didn't get a chance to see. There was that eclipse, a lunar eclipse that was visible for most of North America. So I missed out on that, but I hope some of the listeners got a chance to see that. You know, I have fond memories of standing out in the snow, you know, maybe like 8 or 10, and looking up at the blood red moon, you know, over the front yard of my childhood home in Fairbanks. So yeah, I hope some other folks got the chance to experience that. But yeah, you know, it's by my standards, it's pretty warm. I guess this is winter in New York. Is at least in the city, it's not very cold in November. 45 is really not so bad. So yeah, that's how it is here. Yeah, we'll extend it to you, Georgie. What's it looking like where you're at in the world?
It's 50 degrees here. It's cloudy, and I don't think it's going to rain today, which is a good thing. Usually it rains during the day, you know, during this time of year. It never gets quite cold enough, or rarely gets cold enough to snow, and I miss the snow. Oh, do I miss the snow.
Georgie, that's a good one. I won't lie. I went skiing this morning, and I sometimes love the snow, and then some days when I fall and hit the ground, I hate the snow. So it's really tough. Georgie, I'm sorry. I don't think we ever introduced ourselves as well. We'll do it here on the show to our listeners as well. Kevin, I did my undergraduate degree here in Fairbanks, Alaska. I just finished graduate last spring. Dylan, who graduated before me, also, we were in the same program together. I'm still here in Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm serving as an Alaska fellow working here at Alaska Center ICE. And so really getting opportunity to work with folks here in the communities on entrepreneurship, innovation, you know, and finding ways to connect people through funding opportunities, you know, which I think, Georgie, a lot of our work is very similar. Mine is probably more on the tech side, and like, how do we get people to really, you know, bring an idea to fruition into a company, into a social movement, right? Stuff like that. So that's kind of the work that I've been doing. But not to know over Dylan, I think we're asking all about that too in the chat here. So Dylan, yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah, I graduated a year before Kevin did with my bachelor's BA in anthropology. And now I am a master's student at Columbia in the sociocultural anthropology program. And boy, especially too, if I might go on a brief tangent, these past couple weeks at Columbia, some folks might have heard that the Columbia graduate student workers are on strike, you know, over a contract dispute with the university. And so that has made these past couple weeks very interesting, as the student workers union has asked people, professors, not to teach classes right now, right, as they consider that crossing the picket line. And so some of the alternative ways that we have had class, and you know, sometimes on Zoom, but sometimes meeting elsewhere, has been interesting. So you know, when the strike is done, I might have some good stories to present to everyone, to the listeners and stuff about that. But yeah, that has it's been a lively time here in New York City. And we'll say as well, Georgie, I too miss the snow. It has not snowed yet. I'm really looking forward to it. I know it's supposed to snow at some point.
I'm from New York. It'll snow.
I'll take your word for it. But until then, I'm missing the snow for sure. So, yeah, I guess that's a universal experience for those of us who fall in love with Alaska or live there and then move out of state, right?
On the topic of Alaska, and I know we've already, Jordy, you've mentioned kind of, you know, your connections and your opportunities that you've been here. And for all our listeners who currently are suffering through winter or enjoying winter, either way, maybe could you talk a little bit about your experiences here in Alaska? And I know you've also written a memoir about it. So if you want, maybe talking a little bit about that, that'd be awesome.
My book details one summer in Alaska, my first summer, which was 1977. I was living in Washington, D.C., finishing up my master's, and the opportunity came along. I flew up to Fairbanks from Dulles International Airport, and I was, gobsmacked. I'd never seen anything like this, and the ethnographer I mentioned, Dave Libby, he picked me up at the airport and said, and I said, he goes, "You're going to love Alaska this summer, but you'll look 20 years older in August." And I thought, ooh. We had an orientation, had to learn about survival skills, bear encounters, things like that. And then we flew up to the slope. We were based out of Umiat, and our camp was the Lisburn crowd, and we were the farthest away from base camp, which made it kind of challenging. And I got hypothermia. My boss twisted his ankle and was laid up. He couldn't walk. And back then there was no communication. We had little handheld radios because we'd split into two groups, but you know, if you got sick or you were SOL, but you know, things worked themselves out. My first impression was how clean the air was and how fresh. And then, you know, we all got together, we stayed on campus. We stayed at the door, Nerland Hall, next to Scarland Cabin, which I hope is still there.
It still is, Georgie. And, yep.
Thank you. And that's a historic building. Yeah. And boy, does it have tales to tell. And we all went to the pub, you know, to drink in the evenings. And, you know, we, you know, go outside at 2 a.m. It would be bright sunlight. That was such a shock. And up on the slope, well, we had bear encounters. Oh, my God. Our crew did fairly well, but there was another crew at Lookout Ridge. The boss was Ken Schoenberg. I don't know if you've ever heard that name. My boss was Harvey Shields. And Ken's crew had to, you know, keep watch and bang pots and pans all night long. And for someone who had trouble walking or running around the block because I smoked, going up to this atmosphere was startling. And I didn't think I was going to make it. I did not think I was going to make it at all. I thought I was going to die or I would be asked to leave because I had no skills, no outdoor skills. But I was voted most improved camper by my boss. And I loved every minute of it. Nothing will compare to that summer. The reason I wrote the memoir is because of that. I had help, though. I was working, I think, part-time in Anchorage for the Park Service, who had originally directed the PET4 or NPRA explorations. And they had transcribed our field notes from 1977. So there they were. And back in the 80s, you know, when I was there, or 90s, I guess, I knew I was going to write that book because it was so formative. I would say that is the most important thing that ever happened to me was coming to Alaska. It transformed me into a different person. Second most important thing in my life, the tribal job. You know, I came out of myself even more, and now I'm pretty vocal, and I can be extroverted. But wow, when I thought back about, I mean, I've written a lot of stories about it, excerpts from the memoir about when I got hypothermia. I mean, I didn't realize I was in any danger, but Harvey did. And the other people from the crew who are with me, they said, uh-oh. And they walked me back to camp. They took my clothes off. They put me in a sleeping bag, made me drink hot things and M&Ms, eat M&Ms. And I realized that I had bonded with these people, which is not something I do easily because I'm an only child. But I considered the crew in 1977 my litter mates. And now one of them is dead. So it's a loss. It cannot be filled. It's a void. I was so fond of my boss. He died of cancer. I just can't tell you. And I said, I have to write this book and dedicate it to him. The book is called Tundra, A Memoir of Alaska on Amazon. I was trying to get it published with a regular publisher, and then the pandemic came. I'd written 60 queries, and I said, you know, I'm going to be dead by the time this book comes out if I go the traditional route. People have said they can't find it on Amazon. What you do is you go to the book section. Don't look up Tundra because all this other stuff comes out, like, you know, the car, there's a Tundra car and all this stuff. But look under my name, Georgie Reynolds, and remember that Georgie has three E's, G-E-O-R-G-E-I-E, and Reynolds as in Reynolds Wrap, and you'll find it. I'm working on a book of essays about the Arctic right now, and some of them are in the memoir. The hypothermia is, and a lot of them are from subsequent seasons, like when Mike Kunz killed a ground squirrel with a shotgun. That was a mess, but it was funny. So I've got that written up, and you know, I'll send you anything you want because it's so funny. You know, when I look back on this stuff, it's the stuff you do when you're young. I mean, I wouldn't do stuff like this now unless Mike and Dale Slaughter took me out in the field and hopefully didn't shoot anything. They would have this expression, they're both hunters, and they'd say, you know, I'm just itching to kill something, you know. And of course, the ground squirrel who's getting in the oatmeal, he got it big time. But, you know, those memories I treasure more than anything else I have ever done.
There's something, Georgie, that you've mentioned about field work that it's so alluring. It's, you know, I think, I don't know, maybe the archaeologists today think of field work as you're going out to a site, you're bringing all your gear, it's going to be rough, you know, it's not going to be fun, you know, you're not going to have great stories, but you do, you know. We've had guests on our show who they play music now and they have certain playlists that they listen to back and forth over and over again, and it's like a nightmare but a dream. You know, maybe Georgie, maybe you can talk about a portion of your memoir. There's a statement that I always think of when I go on backpacking trips. It's the most miserable is the most memorable. What was the most miserable moment for you, Georgie? Maybe from the memoir that you could talk a little bit about.
Well, the hypothermia. Yeah.
I was wondering.
Like I said, I didn't know. My feet were like bricks. And I had my hands in my armpits to keep them warm. I had every item of clothing on that I brought with me, which wasn't much. And everyone was much more prepared than I, but they took care of me. And that was the best. And then when Harvey almost broke his ankle and couldn't leave camp, and there were bears in the area, it's like, oh my God, what are we gonna do? And then our last nights in Umiat, where we all got totally plastered and high and just ran amok. Some of the guys actually got one of the telephone poles, the old telephone poles from World War II, and somehow wrestled it to the ground and lit it on fire. So much fun. No one got hurt. No one, you know, didn't fall on anyone. So that was very nice that happened. And then leaving was horrible. I mean, I was on the first plane out because I had to get to Storrs, Connecticut. And I didn't want to leave. I just didn't want to leave. And some days I still wonder why I left. And here's why. In retrospect, Alaska is a transitory place. And most of my good friends are gone. You know, they're starting to die off, unfortunately. And one of my best buddies now lives in Tacoma. Kunz is still around, Dale Slaughter is still around. But other than that, I mean, everyone has kind of gone their own separate way. So if I moved back, it would be kind of sad.
Yeah, I can relate to that insofar as, like, you know, once a chunk of my family started leaving Alaska, right? Like, it's after that, you know, and in, you know, the folks that I met at UAF, right? A lot of them are no longer in state too, you know, a lot of my friends are elsewhere in the world, right? Because a lot of the people who grew up there tend to leave, at least for a while. You know, maybe some of us will come back a few years, you know, down the line. But yeah, it definitely, even for like me who was born there, definitely there's also that feeling of it's not something that necessarily lasts forever. You might come and go back and forth to Alaska over different portions of your life, but it's a very variable thing where very few people are, you know, stick, you know, get there and then stay there forever or stick with it through to the end without, you know, things changing. But on that note, you know, with changing of things, we do have our final question for you. This is another big one, you know, but it is it is the one that we ask everybody. You know, we're equal opportunity in giving people the difficult one here. But so, Georgie, what is anthropology to you?
Well, beyond being the study of man, which is what you learn in school, it's, I think that the, well, let me put it this way. The thing you've got to have to be an anthropologist, including archaeologist, is curiosity. You've got to want to know more. And I think that characterizes all of my friends who are archaeologists and anthropologists. You want to know about the world. You want to know how it ticks. And you want to know how other people make it tick in other cultures. And, you know, I like to travel. I'm always gone somewhere. I just came back from, well, it's a fairly mundane trip. I went to Austria, Italy, and Slovakia. But people are different there, too. You know, and when watching them, I think anthropologists are observers. And the best of us can interact with the culture. I had a discussion with someone in Slovakia. I was lost, and it was in English, German, Russian, and Slovakian. That put me through my paces. So anthropology to me is a love of the world and a sense of curiosity and wonder.
Sense of curiosity and wonder. That is, I really like that. Yeah, that's a pretty good attempt at the definition. I know it is a tricky one. It's always, we enjoy hearing all the various responses. Oh yeah, but no, a sense of curiosity and wonder, I like that. And that is, I guess, in a way, something that we also do try and leave our listeners with, you know, at the end of every show, is always a curiosity and wonder, a desire to learn more, both about anthropology, of course, this is speaking of anthropology as our show, but you know, about the world in general, you know. And just yeah, hopefully folks today, you know, they will leave this episode of Speaking of Anthropology on KSUA 91.5 FM Fairbanks with that sense of curiosity and wonder that you have offered us, Georgie. So thank you so much for coming on the show today.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed this.
Yeah. If you're interested in Georgie's memoir, Tundra, go check it out. It's exciting. And I can't wait to read it now, Georgie, after hearing your stories. But yeah, thank you so much again for joining us today. For more information on Speaking of Anthropology, check out our website. We're here every Friday from 11 to noon on KSUA 91.5 FM Fairbanks. Georgie, any final notes before we sign off here today?
Oh, you had to give me that at the last possible
exactly.
Minute.
That's I always do that. And Dylan knows.
read a lot of books. All my anthro friends read books. Read mysteries, read crap, read classics, read Moby Dick, you know, read adventure stuff. But yeah, you know, get in the groove and stay there.
I love it. Get in the groove. Have a great day, everyone. Thanks so much, Georgie.
You're welcome.